Welcome to Te Matapihi, and thank you for joining us today for the celebration of 40 years since homosexual law reform, the activists, allies, and beyond. We're so thrilled to have you here with us. I'm just going to open with a quick karakia and then some housekeeping, and I will hand it straight over to our incredible guests because we've got lots to talk about. So, Te Matapihi o Nuku, Te Matapihi o Rangi, Te Tiro Whakamuri, Hae Whakamua, Ki Te Matapihi, Ki Te Aonui, Tihe Māori Ora. So just before we start, we've got, in the case of an earthquake, just drop cover and hold. If there is a fire evacuation, please use the stairs. Our assembly point is just by Choose Lane. If there are any other emergencies, just follow staff instructions. Please remain calm. And just let staff know if you have any concerns at all. We have myself, Simon, and Paige in the room with us today. I'll hand straight over to Gareth. Thank you.
Kia ora koutou. My name is Gareth Watkins and I'm the founder of PrideNZ.com, and that's a website that's been documenting rainbow heritage in Wellington and around New Zealand since 2009. And so I'm going to be the MC today, asking some pretty open-ended questions. We've got a stellar panel today. It's a really significant panel because three of the members were there in the early 80s and mid 80s. And I've never said to them this before, but, they really are, you are my heroes and you made my life better. You made my life deeper and broader for what they did and other people during homosexual law reform. So thank you. We have also some younger members of the panel. I'm on the youth side. I was a teenager back in the 80s, so it didn't really occur to me what was happening until kind of 1990s. So it's just such a fantastic opportunity to hear from the people that were there, but also reflections on what it means nowadays. To begin with, just a couple of acknowledgements. One is to David Hinley. So David Hinley was photographing in the 80s, and he photographed a lot of the homosexual law reform activities around Wellington. And it's often David's images that are shown in relation to homosexual law reform. The other one is Jules Topp, and Jules passed away a couple of weeks ago, or very recently. And both Jules and Linda were activists throughout their lives. This is an image of Jules and Linda performing in the town hall as part of homosexual law reform activities. And we have a short clip of Jules. It's a minute long, but it's a lovely piece.
She's not playing.
No,
that's okay.
Tech issue.
Tech issue. So in this piece, Jules was just talking about the need for taking people forward together, that actually together we can achieve a lot of things, and even if you don't agree with somebody, actually taking them forward with you, everyone learns and everyone moves forward. And I think a lot of that happened during law reform, where different groups, disparate groups, came together and for the common aim of passing that legislation. Just one final slide before we start. And this is just giving a bit of context about homosexual law reform in New Zealand. So it was 1840 when the country adopted British law, and with that came the criminalisation of homosexual activity. So that was 1840. It got progressively worse in the 1890s, 1910s, and then in 1962 the Dorian Society was formed. Now that was primarily a social group for gay men in New Zealand, but they had a legal subcommittee that looked at law reform. And so from the early 60s there was a push to have law reform achieved in this country. In 1972, we had the Gay Liberation Movement. A lot of organisations around the country started forming and started demanding change. They weren't asking for it. They were demanding change. And so there was a real kind of groundswell at the time. 1974, we had the first parliamentary attempt at law reform. 1979, we had the second parliamentary attempt. And then Fran Wild's bill in 1985. Fran Wild's bill, one set out to decriminalise homosexual activity between consenting adults, and the second part was to remove discriminate, or make it unlawful to discriminate on the grounds of sexuality. So we'll have some audience questions at the end, so please have a think as we go through. I've got some written down questions to start off us off with. And so the first question I'm going to ask you, whoever's got the microphone, briefly introduce yourselves and tell me, when did you first get involved in law reform? Was it Fran Wild or was it earlier than that?
Well, I guess that I came across homosexual law reform activities when I was a student in the 1960s, but didn't and supported the ideas, but certainly didn't want to get involved. That would be have been too threatening. So it wasn't until shortly before the 1984 election that I had a bookshop, a little communist bookshop in just down the road here in what was then Farrer Street, which was a bit of a gay community centre, and I had been involved in the gay switchboard, which was, you know, one of these pre-internet things which allowed people to talk to other gay and lesbian people. And I'd done a lot of work around AIDS, but hadn't been active in law reform ideas. But Fran sent a message to me saying, would it be possible to organise a meeting between her before the election and gay and lesbian constituents? And so we organised that in the Gay Community Centre on Bullcott Street here. And we got some sort of commitment out of Fran. So we then very careful to invite her back immediately after the election and say, now what are you going to do about this? So that's how I got involved.
And your Bill Lincoln. Thank you. Linda.
Kia ora koutou. My name's Linda Evans. I guess I, my involvement was when I was at university as well, from the late 69, being involved in all the ferment and movements going on at the time, the peace movement, anti-Vietnam War, the anti-apartheid movement, all, you know, there were so many things to get involved in and interested in and all interconnected. And then the beginning of the Women's Liberation Movement was a really exciting time, and developing into lesbian feminism, which is where I mostly found a home. And my interest was mainly in changing the world, really, abolishing sexism, getting rid of compulsory heterosexuality, you know, generally changing things. And it seemed really crucial to have some legislative change to make that possible. And one of the key things was decriminalisation of homosexual acts, because it was so, a whole lot of stuff is so tied in with sexism and so on. So that was, but the first time I really got involved in law reform activity was that first attempt that you mentioned, Gareth, in the 1974 bill. I just came back from living in Australia, and there were all these meetings because Ben Young, a National Party MP, introduced a bill, age of consent 21, which was pretty outrageous to gay liberation, who really wanted equality, of course. And but then the Labor MP for Porirua, Gerard Wall, he said that he would be introducing an amendment to outlaw any positive information about homosexuality going to under 20-year-olds. And this, you know, we've seen these things overseas lately too. But this was like, just meant that you couldn't actually be pro-gay, pro-lesbian, because this, if that passed. So that became equally important to defeat that. And it became quite a big civil liberties thing in the country because, you know, book publishers, authors, all kinds of people didn't, teachers, librarians, wanted that. So that was kind of the first thing that I attended, you know, some meetings, and there were protests. And in the end, that bill failed and the amendment was never brought forward.
Hi, I'm Trevor Mallard and was a Member of Parliament for a very long time. I think I could probably be described as a pretty, in my younger years, as a pretty standard, ignorant, straight male. and knew more about the T than I did about the LGB, because my father had taught Carmen at Tomarui High School. Carmen's name was originally Trevor, although my father says that I wasn't named after Carmen. And I'm also just going to note that we are very much on the site of the balcony, which was a corner of Victoria and Harris Street, so it's probably down that end of this building, which was one of the big nightclubs, and a lot of the avant-garde music was mixed in with the trans strippers, including Georgina Beyer at the time. I got a bit more education when I worked on the ferries, and I shared a cabin with a trans stewardess. It was different, but it was really only in the late 1970s and the early 1980s where I became aware, even that some of my friends and acquaintances were gay, and out of that, the discussions around the legal issues came. As I had friends who were involved in politics, had a good discussion with Vin Young at one stage, and then Fran had told me before the election that, in which I was first elected, that it was her intention to introduce the bill, and I got involved from that point on.
Kia ora, I'm Andre. I was not involved in homosexual law reform. However, I learned about it first about 3 years ago when I started getting into queer history. In high school, I was all about Stonewall. It wasn't until really recently, actually, that I started looking into our own history and what was there. But the most amount that I've learned about homosexual law reform has been through my work at Taranaki. I've been working with Pukeariki to create a queer archive. And I did a lot of research into the prison there. New Plymouth Men's Prison was put aside for multiple decades solely for the imprisonment of men arrested under the Crimes Act for indecent assault against a male, which included any sort of consensual sex between two adult men. And so I think it's actually a really beautiful full, and that was men from all over the country, was sent all the way to Taranaki. Men from Dunedin, Christchurch, Auckland, Taranaki was where they were put. So I think it's a really beautiful full circle moment that Vin Young, who was the National MP for Egmont, actually proposed that first bill that didn't go through, that the first attempt at homosexual law reform came from Taranaki, where all these men were sent. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And we should note as well that Onye does the rainbow tours at Wellington Museum, and to my knowledge, Wellington Museum is the only museum that has a regular rainbow tour, which happens every month, which is really really fantastic.
Last Saturday of every month. Come along. I'd love to see you guys.
Fantastic. So, Bill, describe for me, what is it like when the state is against you?
Well, I guess the point is that there's a lot to be afraid of. And back then, it was not really possible to be openly gay and have a career. It was just too scary, and you wouldn't get promoted, and so you hid. And most people were in the closet. It was a very rare, courageous man in particular, but lesbian too, who would be open about their gayness, except to a very narrow circle. And that fear was to an extent, and you wouldn't want your parents to know, you wouldn't want anyone to know at all. And of course the rate of suicide was very high, the rate of just general self-loathing was very high. It was quite horrible, and to the extent that people hid even from themselves and hid their consciousness of their sexuality from themselves. So very, very deforming. I think that's the key.
Do we know why Fran became the sponsor of this bill? Why did Fran want to do this?
Well, I think she was asked and she made the commitment. I think that was a, you know, that was a key part to it. I think there was a growing awareness in the community generally that it was possible to get a law change, and Fran, you know, Fran was, I don't know how to describe it. She was distanced. She was personally distanced from the lesbian community and the gay community, and could sort of stand up and be a champion without being attacked in the way that, for example, Marilyn Waring had been very shortly beforehand.
You got to remember, though, that there's also the fact that she came from the most educated electorate in the country and the most gay lesbian electorate in the country. And so to, and that she, that the opposition to her usually put up quite socially liberal candidates. So the gay lesbian vote was in contention in Wellington Central, and she wanted to nail it. And she did.
Trevor, why did you join the fight?
I think probably because people asked me to. I mean, I would have always voted for the bill as it came in, but I also, I think, was recognised even back then as having some skills in that I could count, and that was essentially my job. Through the legislation. People remember, it was exceptionally unpopular legislation. Never did it poll at more than 30% through it. MPs were being attacked all the time for being supportive. I mean, I had a 4 and then 5-year-old daughter, and we kept a whistle by the, in those days we all had home lines and no answer phones, we kept a whistle by the phone, and when people said rude things on the phone, she blew the whistle. And that, you know, that was the, It wasn't nice. So my job was to count. I had, I think, over the 18 months or so, probably 150 sheets which had sort of red, green and yellow on them, which indicated, you know, who was voting for it, who wasn't voting for it, and who we had to work on. And so it was mainly my job to work out whose information on MPs' likely votes could be trusted, because you know, it won't surprise you to know that some MPs will tell both sides that they're supporting them.
Linda, why were you fighting?
Well, I think one of the things that was really important to recognise is that lesbians were very much affected by both parts. The homosexual law reform bill introduced in 1985 had two parts, and part one was decriminalisation of homosexual acts between men, and part two was anti-discrimination measures, and both were really important. Lesbians had been affected by male homosexuality being illegal, because many people didn't even realise lesbians weren't. We suffered from the same kinds of discrimination that men did. We didn't go to prison, of course. We weren't prosecuted and go to prison. But we certainly went through forced mental health treatment, same as gay men. Certainly in other parts of the justice system, lesbians were badly treated, accommodation. Lesbians had a lot of trouble keeping custody of their children if they had children before they came out. So there were plenty of ways that lesbians were affected by this legislation. Also, you know, we'd had by then, 12, 13 years since we really strongly started organising as gay liberation and lesbian feminism. And so being proud about who we were, being out about who we were, you know, despite the difficulties, was a really big part of that. We wanted to be part of the campaign and to fight it partly on our terms.
What about you, Bill?
Well, I guess it was mostly a matter of self-respect. I didn't come out until I was about 30. When I told my mum that I was gay, her immediate reaction was, well, you better get the law changed, hadn't you? which was simply a reflex of someone who had led a relatively respectable life and wanted me to have the opportunities that you have from respectability, I think. But it did talk to the fact that the law was terribly closely associated with social acceptance. And in fact, the change in the law wasn't probably nearly as important in and of itself as this battle about social acceptance and the cultural change which occurred through those 16 months of social struggle, of argument in the press and on the streets and in the pubs and around families and people coming out, and that whole process of cultural turmoil which changed attitudes. And the law change was simply a symbolic thing that crystallized, or was that argument was around, but it was actually the cultural change which allowed us to hold ourselves in self-respect.
Onye, when you came across homosexual law reform, what did you think? Because this went on for 16 months. There was some vile stuff said. I mean, for me, it was like another country. What did you think?
I mean, it just felt like it was the dark ages, seeing all those sorts of shots, you know, like Norman Jones, that sort of stuff. Just a really quick tangent. About 2 weeks, well, maybe a month ago, I got a photo of me got posted on NZ First's Facebook account. And going through those comments, it felt like a portal back to what you guys were hearing and what was happening, because it was the exact same stuff that I had never heard said to me online or in person ever in my entire life. But it's the exact same dialogue that was getting said in all the videos, all the audio that I've seen about homosexual law reform. You know, all that, you know, the moralizing of it. So yeah, I'd say that it is amazing how far we have come and how far some people haven't. But also, I think learning about homosexual law reform really gave me an awareness that it is possible with activism to fight things that seem entirely impossible to fight, that seem like they've been enshrined in law for decades, that seem like it's impossible to go forward, that like it can be done and it has been done and we will keep doing it, you know? Yeah.
Absolutely. Let's move on to tactics. And there's a lovely image here of Norman Jones. Bill is up here as well, Jeff Braybrook, and I'm not sure who the other chap is. Perhaps, Bill, you could tell us about that moment, and then we'll throw it open to the rest of the panel in terms of what were the tactics you most remember about the time?
Yeah, that was a meeting by the anti-change folk. It was in the Knox Church Hall in Lohard. And they organised this big meeting against us. And, of course, we went along. And they started saying really nasty, really, really evil shit. Of course, there was a spontaneous reaction against it. And Norman Jones said, this is our meeting, not yours. You've got to shut up. We've paid for this, unless you want to pay $150 or whatever it was. To pay for half the hook. Well, done. We collected the money immediately. I didn't have any money on me. But it was a nice piece of theatre with everyone bringing up little bits of money and putting it in and collecting it in a coat and counting it out and buying the meeting.
People did carry cash.
Yeah, in those days people had cash. And so Alison Laurie, who is one of the great heroes of the whole campaign, and I both spoke, and this is kind of at that, I think that's where I'm saying done probably, yeah, it was a fun meeting.
One of the other things that we should point out is there are a couple of microphones in the shot. And one of those people would be Peter Noland. And Peter was amazing. Still, he's still around in Auckland. But he went around and recorded a lot of these actions. And the actuality from the time is just stunning. And it's Peter is one person that really inspired me to go on and do audio recording for Pride NZ. And one man with a microphone, it's just amazing, preserved forever.
Especially if you're prepared to be just very quiet and just do that. It was, we all got thrown out, but he didn't.
How about you, Linda? What were some kind of tactics that you remember?
Well, I think going back, picking up again what I mentioned briefly before, that whole thing about being ourselves and being out and not having other people speak for us. I mean, it became important, it became clear it was really important to have allies and to have ways that groups that supported us and all the other groups we personally were part of too could speak out. But we also had to take the lead on that, and we had to be out. We had to be, you know, gay, lesbian, would probably say queer now. We had to be as out as possible. And I think that was, that came through in many different situations. And one of them was going to the meetings, and confronting and in those situations so that eventually they did stop having them. Well, they may well have continued having them, but they didn't publicly advertise them. And I think, yeah, another version of that was when we had a Lesbian and Gay Rights Week in April. One of the things that the Lesbian Coalition, which I was part of, organised was advertisements in the paper saying who supported the bill so that any supporters could put their names in. But we had a column for people who were able to be out, and not everyone could because of work in particular, but also because of families and that, but so that we said we, lesbians and gay men, support this bill. And so that was something we borrowed, in a way. I mean, plenty of people do that kind of thing, but just identifying yourself as someone who does something that's either illegal or frowned upon, was a borrowing from French feminists who did the same thing when they were campaigning for abortion. And women who had abortions said it. And a lesbian who's part of the coalition, who had been living in France for a while, she brought that back with her. So there was lots of, you know, input into the different tactics.
And Trevor, what about tactics in Parliament? I mean, I'm aware of people like Norman Jones and Jeff Braybrook. They, at every chance, they would talk about anal intercourse.
Sodomy.
Sodomy, yes. About. Was there any other, what were some of the other tactics in Parliament?
Well, I mean, I'll react to that. That first, and I thought the best comeback to that was Trevor DeClean, who said, "That's fine, as long as they don't make it compulsory." and that brought an element of humour to the place. And Trevor was also responsible for making it absolutely clear that the law on anal intercourse was not gendered. So that was, you know, that was something that not a lot of people focused on. But that, you know, that was, for me, probably the biggest parliamentary tactics issue question was when Fran and a relatively small group of us, you know, I'll go back one step. The majority of the parliament were easily in favour of the change if it was at 18 or 20. The majority of the parliament was against a change at 16. And what we had to do at, or their first choice, you know, was certainly for 18, 20 or no change. And there were two sets of amendments to increase the age from the bill that was introduced to 16 and 18. And one of the hardest decisions we made, one of the hardest things that we did, was to join Jones and Lee and Braybrook and Wall and others in the lobbies to vote down the amendments, because both the anti-change people and the equality people wanted the bill to be in its most radical form at the point it came to the final vote, because both of us, all of us knew that, you know, it was going to be very, very close at the time. The one other technical thing was that my numbers at the end told me that we were going to win by 3 on the third reading of the bill, but we'd had 2 National Party people tell us that that someone else was coming, that, you know, that wasn't prepared to identify, and that person in the end was a guy called Ian McLean from up in the Rotorua area, and he was a surprise vote for the bill. The other technical question we had, and I was in the Ayers lobby at the time, was that there were 2 relatively senior National Party opposition MPs who both became very prominent in their later careers, who had gay brothers and who said that for our family's sake, this bill is not going to fail. They'd made commitments to vote against it, but they were prepared to essentially break their word and go the other way if they were needed. So they waited down the far end of the corridor. You know, we'd talked about this until they got the wave that we'd actually had the numbers, and then they went and voted against it. So that was an interesting, I don't know what I think about them. They were there if needed, and that was really good. But their personal views and beliefs and the commitments that we made weren't those consistent with loving their brother in both cases.
Because it is really important to think of all of these attempts, including the successful one, as private members' bills. Mm. And therefore, supposedly, people could vote with their conscience. All equally, it meant for those of us supporting the legislation, we had to work quite hard to support MPs and their electorates, because even quite pro-MPs wanted us to do things that showed they had support in their electorates. Mm. So kind of the whole tone of the campaign was determined in a way by it being private members' bills, wasn't it? The support campaign.
It certainly was. It was, people from... I mean, it wasn't even between the 2 major parties, but it was obviously more Labor than National and the other way around. And, you know, I was a marginal seat MP. All the indications were that it would be adverse. Actually, if you look at the marginality of the supporters, they were much more marginal seats than others. But in the end, it was so important to get it there, because we knew that it would take at least another decade, if not longer, to get there if it wasn't passed.
Yeah, it would have been a disaster if it hadn't been passed, because the defeat would have push thing. It wouldn't have just stayed where it was. There would have been a reactionary move, a tightening up, a greater enforcement of the law, and a reinforcement of the fears which were conditioning our lives. It would have been really bad.
And it would have been very difficult to run public health campaigns around HIV/AIDS without it. That was kind of one of the other backdrops that was so important.
It was exactly the same timing.
Yeah. I mean, it is rather mad to run a homosexual law reform campaign at the height of an AIDS panic, but it worked, and their attempt to use AIDS against us rebounded on them, because we were able to say, well, look, if you think about it, the possibility of talking openly about gayness and sex and your own sexual practices is a precondition for decent discussion about how you stop AIDS spreading. And we managed to do that, but sometimes it hung in the balance in a very difficult way.
Today also gives us an opportunity to pay tribute to either people that aren't in the room or are no longer with us. And I was just going to ask the panelists, starting with you, is there anyone that you would like to pay tribute to in relation to law reform and what you know about law reform?
I mean, I'm not going to pick a specific individual just because, but also I would really love to shout out to all the men in New Plymouth Men's Prison who saw just the absolute worst of this, who got put in cells that were an arm's width of size, who were forced to do hard labor for decades, some who died in prison. This was obviously way before homosexual law reform, mm-hmm. but that was some of the people who suffered quite a lot because of it. But yeah.
I mean, because it's topical, I'm going to think the Tops. I mean, they did manage to bring humour to the campaign. I was lucky in the summer of 85, 86. We had a tour around the Waikato. I lived in the Waikato and Coromandel, which was actually more building support for the anti-nuclear movement. But, you know, this was overhanging and there were, you know, the beach concerts, maybe 15 of them around over about a week-long period. And they were fantastic. Afterwards, they came, Annette King and I were involved in it. Peter Garrett was involved in it, for part of it. And afterwards, they came to Wellington and Annette and I took them to Bellamy's to lunch. And in those days, because Parliament was smaller, you could sit down the back, if you were a guest and Annette and I decided to take them down for the house at 2:30 as it was then. And so they could sit down the back, and the messengers, as they went to go in, said to them, "Gentlemen, you're required to wear a tie." And you could hear them laughing all the way around the building. But then the fact that they had been there, it just sent, especially Norm Jones, right off. Mm-hmm. It was worth it just to see him so unhappy. Not that I'm nasty, really, but, you know.
Well, there's so many people, you know, especially of all the people who were there at all the meetings and in the many organisations, and in particular the men who later died, you know, soon, some of them quite soon from HIV/AIDS. But I guess that I'd like to just pick out a couple of lesbians that I worked with closely during the time, and the main one is, as Bill referred, to Alison Laurie, who was my partner at the time, who was just a real powerhouse, put the same as Bill, took time off work, didn't earn money, just campaigned, you know, a lot of the time, which a number of people did. And, you know, she had connections way back from her young days in the communities back to the early 60s. She had overseas connections from living overseas. She had worked with Labour Party women, so she had connections in the party, and she just did a great job as a lesbian organiser and one of the spokespeople for the Gay Task Force. Then another person who was much organised herself much more quietly was Pauline Simmons, who had been there since the beginning of lesbian groups in New Zealand, and a feminist, and totally, totally committed to the age of consent of 16. And then the other person, so Alison and Pauline have both died, but the other person who is very much still alive is Tiki Enstone, who was a really big personality during the campaign and very out there, and was one of the founders of the Coalition in Support of the Bill, which brought in unions and a lot of other, and feminist organisations, so that was really important, and who often attended events dressed in her as one of her many alter egos. One of them called Cynthia Bagwash, dressed in evening wear of a much earlier period. And a fox fur. And when we had an action at the Human Rights Commission just a couple of years before the campaign, the Human Rights Commission General Secretary didn't want to deal with us, all there in our work clothes, in our lunchtime, but he spoke exclusively to Cynthia Bagwash. We always enjoyed that this fictional character with a very strange, you know, upper-class accent and a fox fur had all the credibility at the Human Rights Commission at the time. Anyway, so those are, there's so many people though, there's just so many people who did wonderful things, brave things, you know, small actions in their sphere of influence.
There's one person who it's really just come to me that I think we should acknowledge, and that's Ruth Dyson. Ruth Ruth gave up her job in Christchurch. She came, she lived at, Fran was a solo mother, she lived at her place, took basically primary responsibility for the two kids who I think was both still at primary school at that stage, and then worked during the daytime while the kids were at school on the campaign, and was very, very good at getting people organised. But she worked for over a year on a voluntary basis, sort of full-time between those two roles. And I think or some of us would argue about Fran's sanity through the process. She'd get very, very wound up, but she had a really good leavening effect on Fran and helped in that way.
There's a lovely photo on the screen at the moment of yourself, Fran and Ruth, I think. Is that on the night that the bill went?
That's a night. And I've forgotten what the name of the gay nightclub that is in Oranville Bay that was in the White House.
The Victoria Club.
Mm. Yeah, that's where at least one of the celebrations occurred. Yeah. But I think it's fair to say that there was a lot of laughing and crying that night. Mm. It was in about equal measures.
Mm. Now, that was a pretty wonderful night, of course, having had a victory like that. You don't get many victories quite as clear cut as that. And it was an amazing sort of moment. That bunch of women that Linda talked about were really amazing to work with. And Alison particularly and I would argue a lot. But we wouldn't necessarily agree all the time at the end of our arguments. But we had an extremely valuable working relationship, which is actually something I remember as one of the highlights of my of political activity in a life which has done a lot of street level political activity. I guess that the backdrop of AIDS was extremely important. Bruce Burnett, who died very early on in the campaign, actually, but his contribution before he died in getting it through to AIDS activists, the importance of this law reform, actually probably had a critical impact on the outcome. I remember him primarily as an AIDS activist and putting together the apparatus which carried the gay male community through that. And he was a good friend. But that political contribution isn't usually noticed because it happened behind closed doors. But I think it was a hugely important one. And in the same campaign, and really represented many, many other people. There was a fellow called Tommy McLean, who was a funny little Scotsman who was working all the time, leafleting and collecting signatures and activating, right through the winter of 1985. Into 86, of course. And he contracted HIV and died a year or so afterwards. And played a, you know, he put a huge amount into it. But he represented a passion which spread right through our communities, where people would get together to write letters, get together to leaflet, get together to attack meetings of the opposition, get together to picket Salvation Army weekly, whatever they do. And this passionate community activism by hundreds of people, which Tommy, I think, represents quite nicely.
Thank you. So I have one final question before we have hopefully some time for questions. We might run a little over if that's slightly
couple minutes over? Yep. Oh, that's good. Thumbs up. So my final question to you all is, how did homosexual law reform change you?
I guess it made me realise how important it is to be a difficult person and how important it is to work with other difficult people. Yeah. You can't allow yourself to fit too easily.
Are you looking at me because I'm another difficult person?
I would never say that.
I think while I knew that there was a lot of hostility to lesbians and to gay men, having to kind of constantly confront the depths of it, there was both the depths of, you know, the opposition, but the fact that other people who might have been people, you know, we loved and cared about could be manipulated by misinformation into sharing in that hostility, into signing petitions against us, into thinking we were all a danger to children, you know. It was really confronting to have to come to terms with that on such a big scale, which was, in a way, kind of why we had to react with both anger and the humour that Trevor mentioned, because that became a really important thing for us to hook into from the sort of old cultures, that there's always been this camp humour, lesbian humour, things that we can use in these situations. But having to deal with that, you know, realise that that hostility was there and could be stirred up was quite confronting.
I think for me it's probably in two ways. One was it did hone my personal skills as a politician, you know, around numbers and around how the process worked. And I was responsible for closing down the select committee because the opponents wanted to stretch it out so that it became an election year issue. And I very undemocratically sort of led the select committee not to do that so we could get it out of the way in 1986 and not have it there in 1987. I'd probably criticise myself now if I thought about it carefully, because it's a parliamentary and a political, in a parliamentary sense, it's a very bad thing to do. But for me, it's just been a richness of understanding the diversity of New Zealand. That was what the process did for me, and I think it made me a better person.
I think the impact that homosexual law reform had on my life is just completely unmeasurable. And I think for all the people of my generation, you know, we still obviously have to deal with homophobia and transphobia in certain ways, in certain places, but just, that's what gets me whenever I get into all the research and I read any of this, is just how huge it was, how almost, it almost even felt like universal. Whereas now, I think, I'm just thinking about the definitions of woman and man bill, which the protest was for yesterday, and which submissions are open, by the way. We are arguing against something that's coming in, rather than something that has been there solid for decades. It's a completely different, you know, playing field, and it's a completely different emotion and experience. And I think that homosexual law reform has just so much to do with what we are able to do now, undoubtedly.
One final question. I said that before. What was it like on the night that it passed? Can you describe what that feeling was like?
Well, for me, in the early part of the night, it was a state of extreme nerves, because I knew that there was an entire community were relying on the numbers, which could flick really easily. You know, people not turn up, people change their minds, and as I said, it was three. So first of all, it was nerves, and then relief, and then I think I said before, we both laughed and cried the night away, because it had been such an important part of our lives for that year.
I don't know if you remember Trevor, you came into the Victoria Club and I threw my arms around you and you were visibly shocked. You hadn't quite expected quite such an enthusiastic response.
No, I hadn't. I knew people would be happy, but I also knew there was a history. You know, there's a history there. I mean, history for me actually went back to 1972 with David Shand, who was a gay candidate for Wellington Central, who was elected to the Parliament on the night, and then lost on the special vote. So he was part of the group that Kirk Cabinet. And actually there's a whole pile of history because he was a very good economist and government accountant, and Roger Douglas would never have happened if that event hadn't been overturned.
Exhaustion was one of the prime things. It was really, I hadn't had to keep going quite the same way that you had counting numbers, but, also just an incredible sense of relief because, to my mind, if we had not defeated that movement against the Homosexual Law Reform Bill, then we would be a lot worse off. So that was kind of like a defeat of that kind of moral religious right in New Zealand. And it was good to do it fairly early on in the piece. It was clear that they were interested in moving on to other issues that mainly ones that primarily affected women, abortion, in particular, but other things as well. And I just felt like to defeat that religious right wing early on in the piece was really, really important.
Thank you. Thank you all. We do have...
Sorrow, there was sorrow about the loss of part two, because that would take us another 7 years to get the anti-discrimination stuff.
Thank you. We do have a couple of minutes for questions or memories, some short questions, short memories. Just raise your hand and we'll pass a mic to you. I think we've got Kay over here.
Kia ora, I'm Kay Jones. And really quick comment, then a question. The quick comment is the thanks to Phil Parkinson of the National Gay Task Force for doing such wonderful behind-the-scenes research and supporting the team. So not everybody knows his name, but it's, you know, that whole thing. Archives and research are vitally important. Now, the question, which is a little bit more tricky, I love all the work that all the people did for the campaigns then, but as we've already mentioned, we had a march and rally yesterday about a bill that is basically attacking gender minorities communities. And I have concerns and sadness about the numbers of lesbian activists who were involved in supporting homosexual law reform who are now on the other side, standing with right-wing religious people. And I like, this, as I say, it saddens me. I'm just wondering, how can we try and bridge that gap? What is there that has, I don't know if it's turning people to that? Is there some way that we can actually bring people back to see that this is a human rights issue and this is about, you know, doing all those things that homosexual law reform was about too, you know. Anyway, any thoughts on how we can bridge that gap and bring people back in, particularly older lesbian activists?
Well, I saw Disclosure Day last night. Great movie, by the way. I can't tell you how it ends, but oh my God, that was what I was going to say. I think bringing people together and talking and not immediately cancelling people. I think, as Jules Topp would have said if we'd played that audio, that actually you need to bring people with you. And people change over time. I think that's, you know, we just have to acknowledge that. People's views do change over time, don't they?
I don't agree with this bill because I don't think it's good for women as much as, you know, any other communities. So I think... But I do think that in the LGBTQ combination of communities, there has not been a lot of respect shown for lesbians and lesbian politics and the kinds of issues that have been really important to lesbians over the years. And I think had that happened, then there could have been much more of a way to find room for each other, or I hope that anyway, because I just feel like that it's been much harder to discuss things than it used to be. And I'm not saying it was necessarily easy in the past, but the fact that there's kind of no room. I mean, I guess what happened during this period we've been talking about is a whole lot of people who didn't necessarily agree with each other, or who had, you know, some disagreements and some agreements, managed to somehow come together because we were under attack, under a pretty destructive attack. So it's hard to know what you can do when that atmosphere isn't quite the same, but I do think it's important to work out ways that people can coexist.
I'm genuinely curious, how can we, as, you know, show respect to the lesbian community, which has done obviously so much for homosexual law reform, how can that happen? Like, what does that look like? I'm just wondering.
Well, it's something I would have to think about a bit more, but I do think that lesbians early on became a target and were an easy target because they were not really well supported. And so I would like to kind of almost dismantle things and go back to the beginning of that and work out how to discuss things better.
Mm. Yes, it does seem to me that lesbians can become a target. It's also clear to me that trans folk are a target, and perhaps a more immediate target in the present environment. I think that one of the lessons of homosexual law reform is that we must unite around the most vulnerable. We stood out for 16. There were a lot of older people who thought that that was wrong and we should dilute that and forget it and not look after our youngest people. That would have been a crime. I think that the queer communities right now have a responsibility to look after their most vulnerable. And I think in my work as a counsellor anyway, I see the most vulnerable people as being young trans folk.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? Oh, yes. Let's go back first and then Ramona.
Thank you very much for saying right at the very beginning that one of the things that has happened in the past is that we've worked together even when we disagree with each other. And I think that has been one of the fabulous things about the rainbow communities, that we know that there's things where we disagree and we know where we can unite. And so I would like lesbian groups who disagree with other parts or other communities within the rainbow communities to be allowed to join in on rainbow communities events rather than being barred. And I think that's, it then gives us the opportunity to talk about our differences and think about our differences and listen to each other. So I've always, Alison and I used to argue all the time, and it was great. And I'd like there to be more of that going on now. But thanks for pointing that out.
Thank you. And just at the front here.
Kia ora tatou. One of my things was, there are several things, is that in a march, my sister went on the anti homosexual law reform. My brother walked beside her and said, who looked after us when we were teenagers and our parents weren't there? Who looked after us? Who brought food to our schools? And she pulled out of the march. Now, the next thing that happened on that is people, Māori did not always believe in homosexual law reform. When we used to take bodies back that had died, and we had trans people and gay people, they would always say, no, it wasn't AIDS, not the people, it's cancer. And we would say, well, You've got all these queens taking the body on. Do you think there might be something here? The other thing on that was when the marriage thing came up, my sister said to me, we love both you and Bill, but why do you want to get married? You already have civil union. And I said, if we don't get married, or if we do get married, I will stop going against straight people who are married. And when my sister got married, she asked Bill to marry her, and I was to take her down the aisle. So she had a complete change. Whenever we have a family thing, you better be bringing Bill with you, otherwise stay at home. Kia ora tātou.
Kia ora. Well, I think it's probably about time to wrap up. There was one small thing that I would love to do, which is, and I'd love to, hopefully you would join with me in doing a dedication of today, because I think for me it's incredibly special to have these people in the room. Really super and really super significant. And I just wanted to do a dedication to all of the Rainbow ancestors who never got to experience today, that never got to experience the freedoms we have today and the freedoms that they and their allies fought for. And also to dedicate it to the Rainbow people around the world that still don't have these freedoms. And to dedicate it to you all, because we actually all need to get on. We all need to do the work together. And there's a lot of work to do. So thank you so much for coming. Thank you to the panelists. A huge round of applause. Thanks.
And I'm just going to say I look forward to the repeat in another decade.
I'd just like to say on behalf of the library, thank you all so much for sharing your memories, your experiences, your thoughts. It's incredibly valuable and we really appreciate it. And we're thrilled to have you here and thrilled to celebrate this anniversary with you at Te Marapihi. And thank you, Gareth, for all the extra work you've put into this event. It's really special. I'll just close with the karakia. Kia tō, rangi marie, ki runga I a tātou katoa, au te pō, pō te au. Humie, huie, tai, kie. Kia ora.